Hey, I'm Amanda from Trifecta Fitness. We're proud to be Clarksville's new Get Fit headquarters. Trifecta Fitness is a state-of-the-art spin and strength training studio. Our spin studio is truly one of a kind in this area, complete with 20 state-of-the-art live fitness bikes and an incredible sound system. Our strength training is done in small groups of six or fewer, and all of our strength and spin classes are scalable for every level of experience. Come see us in the heart of Clarksville, just behind MAPCO at the corner of Old Trenton Road and Wilma Rudolph Boulevard. Call us for more info at 931-542-6265 or download our Trifecta Fitness app for a full list of upcoming classes.
In October 2019, Arlington, Texas was chosen to be the home of a new national museum, unlike any other. The National Medal of Honor Museum will be a unique home of military history. The 100,000 square foot museum will house exhibits, archives, and artifacts relating to the 3,500 U.S. troops who have been awarded the medal, the nation's highest honor for valor in combat. The museum will have 31,000 square feet of galleries dedicated to U.S. troops who have received the award. The museum CEO, former Navy SEAL and NASA astronaut Chris Cassidy, said the museum will focus on education as much as preservation. The building will have five areas dedicated to Medal of Honor winners from the Army, Marine Corps, Navy, Air Force, and Coast Guard. The main gallery will be located in a central plaza under a 25,000 square foot slab of steel, which will appear to be suspended in midair. It will be supported by five pillars. Black Rifle Coffee is a corporate sponsor of the museum, as are the Dallas Cowboys. The museum's board also includes over a dozen major corporations and six Medal of Honor recipients, including David Bellavia, Patrick Brady, and Britt Slabinski. Army Staff Sergeant Bellavia was awarded the medal for clearing an entire house by himself on November 10, 2004, as a squad leader in support of Operation Phantom Fury in Fallujah, Iraq. He killed four enemy fighters and wounded a fifth in close quarters battle. Army Major General Brady flew and coordinated the evacuation of 51 seriously wounded men during a firefight in Vietnam in January 1968. Slabinski, a Navy SEAL chief and team leader, led a rescue team of SEALs during Operation Anaconda in Afghanistan in March 2002. Slabinski and his team flew to a mountaintop ambush site to rescue Petty Officer First Class Neil Roberts, who had fallen from the back of a helicopter. Slabinski led the team through almost constant combat against an entrenched Taliban force. Along with the board members, former presidents Jimmy Carter, Bill Clinton, George W. Bush, and Barack Obama serve as honorary directors. The museum is expected to open to the public in late 2024.
All right. Welcome back.
Misfit Nation Show.
We are a show founded by a veteran and hosted by two veterans and a military spouse. Our mission is to get people to tell their stories to the world. If you're an author, share your tips with the Misfit Nation. If you're a musician or an actor, our audience needs to know how they too can get into the business. Coaches, we love our coaches. Come on and share your tips with the Misfit Nation to help them become better versions of themselves. If you are a corporate leader or an entrepreneur, come on and show how you did it and how hard you have fought for success. If you are a veteran, first responder, or Gold Star family, we would love to have you come on and share your story with the Misfit Nation. We always have time for you. If you're feeling down, alone, or starting to see the darkness, stop. Think about those who are around you. You are not alone. You will be missed. If you feel like your problems will be a burden to those in your inner circle or feel embarrassed, dial 988. If you are a veteran, take option one. We need you to keep pushing forward. Don't make a permanent solution to a temporary problem. If you are a new listener, welcome to the Misfit Nation Show. Be sure to subscribe to our show on your favorite podcast app. Also on our YouTube channel at @_MisfitNation. Subscribe and click the bell to keep you up to date on our latest episodes and all of our news. You can also find us on Heroes Media Group and About Face Radio. Now, let's get to the show!
All right, all right, all right. Welcome back to the Misfit Nation Thursday After Dinner Show. Hopefully everyone is crushed this February and got to the leap day and lift everything out on the table for the next 4 years for February 29th. So you don't have to worry about February 29th for another 4 years and an extra day of the year. Tonight we have a good guest. He has led an extraordinary life. After escaping an abusive childhood at age 13 to become a homeless runaway, he worked alongside migrant workers before he earned 3 degrees by age 25, including acceptance to Harvard MBA and a scholarship from the University of Arizona. Recognized for his innovations in building a macroeconomic that outperformed the Federal Reserve and changed how economics are still built to this day. Now a multiple award-winning author of thrillers, most often compared to Dan Brown, every one of his stories and characters pull a rich life of diverse experiences grounded with deep, deep research. Every story is based on true events, history, technologies, or personal experiences. For example, both Swarm and The Lost Ark feature the true story of a program that escaped NSA spy labs and confirmed by an FBI visit to his home. So without further ado, let's welcome Guy Morris, author and researcher in Teleaction Thrillers. Welcome, Guy.
Rich, thank you for having me. It's an honor.
It's great to have you here. I know I say this all the time, it's a lot better now that the world's a lot closer together thanks to the internet, so we can actually link up like this and be able to talk. Otherwise, it'd be hard for me and you to actually ever meet each other. So this is awesome to have you here on the Misfit Nation and able to share your story with our audience.
Thank you. Thank you. It's my pleasure. Yeah. And the technology is amazing. And we, you know, those of us who've been around even a little while have seen the transformation of the world that it's brought, and both the good and the bad. And but it's absolutely astounding, the fact that we can now converse, we can see each other in real time. It doesn't matter where we are. It's just astounding way of bringing the world together in new ways we never had.
It definitely is. And Guy, I gave basically two parts of your bio there. I tried to skip around not to give all your story out, to let you say some of your story. So if you don't mind, go back as far as you want and tell a little more about yourself and bring us to where we are today.
Well, I think if anything, I'm somewhat of a survivor. I'm someone who's positive enough to say that I never wanted to have my past define my future, even when my past were my own mistakes. And it's been a continual life of trying to push the boundaries for myself and for whatever field I was working on at the time. And I've been honored. I've been privileged to go from sleeping under, you know, storm shelters and bridges to flying corporate jets and sleeping at five-star hotels and working with executives and CEOs and geniuses, some of the best in the world. And so it's been a great honor, and I try to kind of bring that into my writing now. Now that I'm retired, I'm enjoying a new third act career and trying to bring a lot of the experiences and the things I've learned and the things that I've observed in doing all that, including the highs and the lows, the successes and the failures, into what I'm hoping are page-turning novels that are thought-provoking and hopefully at some level life-changing.
Definitely. I think anytime someone picks up a book, it's one for the story, and two, just like you said, maybe they'll change something, their path, either make them a writer, or maybe something in that book will resonate with them to maybe make different choices in life. And I think that's a challenge many writers take on without even knowing it.
It's a big challenge. It's a big challenge. But if you really want, I mean, and there are a lot of authors that are, well, and I don't want to say the word formula, but there's a formulaic approach to what they do and how they do it and how they're developing characters. It's a genre, there's a style, and they might want to be having the truth about a character, maybe the truth about an incident, maybe the truth about a true incident. They are trying to find a truth of sorts. I worked with a lot of authors, and I know a lot of them really take a lot of care into trying to figure out what they're going to write about.
Right.
Yeah.
I had a couple on here, one just based on my audio side today, Terry Brown, and she does some of the best research I've seen for a person to do. She gets an idea, then just researches it to death. So she has the book that is going to be great and have a great product for the world to see. She's been on my show 3 years in a row on the release date of her books. So she's part of the family now, and it's just great to see her process and how that works for her as well.
Excellent. Yeah. And research to me and it is the most critical part of anything I write. I'll probably spend a third of the time writing a book just researching the topics involved. Even once I start writing, I'm constantly doing research to update a topic or to get more details or information. Because to me, if it can be a plausible scenario, if it resonates as plausible and real, then it has more of an impact. If I'm reading something like a Dune, which is a great literary piece of fiction that has a lot of parallels to our current world, but when we're talking about things that are actually rooted in history, technology, politics, current events, science studies, and actual things that are going on around us, it takes on a new level of pseudo reality. And I think that the great, you know, War of the Worlds kind of example was a really good first primer for that. Something that felt like it was real. And so a lot of people at the time, Orson Welles thought it was real. And so I'm trying to kind of bring a little bit of that into my books as well.
That helps out a lot. I think Dune, like you said, is a great literary piece. More people need to read it. And not just go look at the movies and stuff that are based off of it. That way they can actually see the process that went into it. That's a great book to start off reading, then maybe become a writer or get the love of winning a book.
Yeah. I would have loved to have seen that War of the Worlds though, alongside the confessions from the Congress that says, yeah, we actually have these UAPs. We don't know what they are. I think. We had a few generations or a few decades to kind of get used to the idea and kind of get into our psyche so that when the truth was announced, the panic wasn't near as high as I think a lot of people thought that might be.
Well, everything that comes out now incites panic, no matter if it's good or bad. If panic comes out, that's what people live on. I think they thrive on panic now. So that's why milk and bread gets sold out of every grocery store.
Some people storm. Do, yeah.
So you went from being the world of economics that you can probably, some people get into that and they like to poke their eyes out halfway through. You thrived there.
Well, yeah, I was a street kid, and somehow economics, the whole idea of, you know, supply, demand, plus and minus, who has, who doesn't have, labor rates, you know, working with migrant workers and watching people drive by with rolls. I think I had an intuitive sense to it, and I was pretty good. And what happened was, a macroeconomic model is like a computer model that does forecast. It's similar to climate change models. It's basically a computer simulation of real world events and what kinds of factors lead to what kinds of changes, and things like predicting where GNP is going to be and where interest rates are going to be and where the unemployment is going to be has tremendous, tremendous value to stock markets and business planners and logistics experts and to government experts. And so accuracy of those models is extremely important. And at the time, many of the models, the best models in the world, Federal Reserve, Wharton Business School, Harvard Business School, Northwestern Business School, Stanford Business School, were struggling with at a time when we had high unemployment, high inflation, and high growth at the same time. And they needed a new factor to bring into it. And I developed a theory that there was a productivity value to technology sales that was not being at the time being incorporated into these models. So I actually found the data, developed the algorithms, built the model, and I not only and it beat everybody by a wide margin. And it changed the way we think about modeling today. And so for an additional 10 years after that, you saw the Federal Reserve Chairman, Paul Volcker, talk about the productivity value of technology and how that was driving certain types of economic parameters. And so I was the one to develop those theories initially. Now, because of that, it got me into some great jobs. I got my first role was with IBM. I moved from there to a role working for the next biggest mainframe manufacturer at the time called Burroughs. I then went to work with Global Energy and got to work with an international multi-billion dollar international oil and exploration company with access up to the board of directors and VPs and working with the corporate senior staff. Did some startups. I worked with Oracle. I've worked with Microsoft. And throughout my 40 years, so everywhere from the implementations of putting the first desktop on in somebody's desk in the enterprise through to, you know, the latest of cloud computing and artificial technology, intelligence technology, at some point or another, I've been involved in either implementing it from an enterprise side or consulting and implementing it from a software technology side. And so it's given me a lot of great great experiences working with some amazing people. But I've learned some things out of that, and that's where I kind of point into my books.
Did you always want to be a writer, or is that just something that just kind of clicked as you went through that career and all of a sudden somewhere in it, I want to be a writer now?
No, I didn't start off wanting to be a writer. I mean, yes and no. I wanted to be a songwriter for a long number of years and actually did some contract writing for Disney and recorded several CDs and thought that that was really where my path might lie. But I also was a young guy with a family, and I had a family to support, and I couldn't do that on the income of a first start author or first start songwriter. I started learning to love to write longer fictional content when my son, about 30, 35 years ago, when my son was like 11 or 12, I wrote a short story for him called Paolo and the Shark. And he loved it. His cousins loved it. It was really popular in the family. I never bothered to publish it. It was just something to do because I was a single parent. I had lots of time on my hands. But that inspired me. That I enjoyed that experience so much that when I went to write a sequel for him, I wanted it based on something real. So I started doing research into real. Now, of course, the first book was back in the 1600s, and it, you know, had to do with the Caribbean and, you know, had sort of, you know, flavors of pirates and lost treasures and, you know, that ghosts and that kind of thing, the kinds of things that a 12-year-old would want to read, right? So I wanted it based on something real. And when I discovered a true mystery of Henry Morgan and his abandoned, not lost, but abandoned billion-dollar plunder of Panama that went missing with three ships and 600 souls, I got intrigued, and I wound up spending 12 years researching the history, the archaeology, the mythology to solve the mystery of what happened to 35 tons of plunder worth $1 billion to $1.5 billion, 600 souls and three ships. And then what happened to Morgan, because afterwards, when he had the power to go back for it, he went insane, burned his logbooks to keep the world from ever knowing why he was abandoning $1 billion. And then 3 years after he died, the whole city of Port Real sank into the ocean in an earthquake tsunami. At the time, the locals said they'd been cursed by Morgan. I wanted to find out what happened to Morgan that traumatized him so deeply that he would abandon $1 billion plunder. And so it took me many years to really kind of revolve around that. By the time I was done, I had finished starting to do the research. He was grown, gone, and didn't really want a book. So that became that research, you know, was sort of part-time. I still had a career that I was working 70-80 hours or more a week. And so this was all sort of the things I would do to balance the left brain and the right brain.
Okay, yeah, so you balance yourself out. You did that yin and yang thing just for yourself, right there within yourself, and now it is your passion now. So that's
now
that's
once awesome I retired, that was what I knew I wanted to do. That it had been building up in me for a long enough time that once I retired, then I said, okay, I had enough stories, not only the story about Morgan, which turned into my award-winning book called The Curse of Cortez, Book Trip called it Indiana Jones meets Da Vinci Code. But when I do signing events, I like to tell people Indiana Jones meets the Goonies for grown-ups sprinkled with Stephen King. And then the espionage books. Now, the espionage books you mentioned in my introduction was really based on a true experience of discovering that a program had escaped the Lawrence Livermore Labs at Sandia, which is an NSA spy lab. That's the same laboratory that created the infamous Stuxnet virus. And so at first I thought it might have been a typo. Maybe it was supposed to say the program was lost or stolen or corrupted or malfunctioned. But the verb that it used in the Associated Press article was that it had escaped. Again, it was one of those things where I couldn't put the idea down. I wound up reverse engineering what would it mean for a program to escape? Could it actually be architected to do that? And if so, what did the NSA want it to do? What kind of spy did it want it to be that it needed that stealth technology? And when I did, I had two FBI agents show up at my door. They were, we had decided, once I figured it out, I didn't think anything of it. We produced a webisode series, an espionage webisode series, talking about this spy program that had escaped and what it's doing now and how it was architected and what it could do and all of these things. And a studio, we had tons of fans all over the world, including one of the director of flight operation from the NASA Space Center, whose alias was orbit@nasa.gov, was one of my fans who would email me 2 weeks before one of our studio options was to come due. Two FBI agents showed up. So they were very upset that I had figured out something that they thought was supposed to be top secret and had the audacity to actually produce a webisode series about it. What bothered them even more was my snarky attitude. I was like, yes, I did it. I figured it out. Oh, man, this is so really cool. Oh, come on, boys, admit it. You wouldn't be here if I was wrong. So I said, I must have nailed it. Oh, just come on and tell me. So they didn't like my attitude even a little bit, had no sense of humor. But I knew at that point what that event did for me was it started me deeply researching and thinking harder about all of the technologies that we were releasing on a commercial level to improve the enterprise. What would I do with those same technologies if I were part of the NSA? If I were the James Bond mythical Q? If I were using those technologies, not in the sci-fi sense of what can I do 10 years from now, but what can I do in the laboratory today and how would I be using that for espionage, cybersecurity, national security, national defense, cyber weaponry, lethal AI weapon systems? How would I be using these technologies in that context? And I think that began the path towards Swarm and the Last Ark.
I mean, that's an awesome journey right there. Oh, too bad you couldn't get the picture of you with the FBI guys at your door to...
That would have sent them over the top. They already gave me the "we are not amused" speech, and I said, "Well, I didn't break any laws. So what are you going to do, bust me for being a smarty pants speech?" So yeah, it was not. They were not happy when they left.
I was trying to hold in my laugh when you were saying it, because anytime that kind of stuff happens, it's funny because you're not doing anything malicious. It's just that you found something that they've probably been looking for forever.
Well, I figured out what had happened and why it had happened. And it's obvious why they wanted me to be quiet about it, knowing that it was real. But for me, it was just validation. And so again, that after they left and after my wife gave me the "what the hell did you do" speech, I started really thinking about, well, what are they really using this for? If they could create it once, they could create it a second time with better guardrails. And what are they doing? And ironically, a number of years later, I was at Microsoft when the Prism project came through. So, I was starting to connect the dots even then.
It all comes together in the end. Circle. Mm-hmm. I was watching a documentary the last 2 days, the American Conspiracy, about the Octopus Project or the Octopus issue. And it's pretty intriguing just to see all those dots get connected just by a journalist. He did all the connecting and wound up, of course, killed. And that's why they made this documentary. Yeah. Once he started exposing people, bad things happen to people when you do that.
And I suppose if I had been a journalist, I would have followed up. I would have followed up with interviews at the Lawrence Livermore Labs. I would have followed up with the FBI. I would have followed up on this. What is it that you're not telling the, what is this used for? At the time, I was hoping to maybe make some money with one of the studios before I went to my next job, which I think was either Startup or Oracle. I can't remember now. But I continued on my professional career. But this always kind of stayed in the back of my mind. And so when I retired, that became the character. The program that escaped is now a character in both of the books. So it's the main character within the series. And is actually bringing in sort of, it's already left the NSA, and it's now starting to bring a different perspective on the world that I could never get any other human character to provide, and so it creates for a very interesting literary vehicle.
That's amazing. That's awesome for development and the way you can grow it within the series. That's good as well.
And it allowed me to bring in two other really major issues too, which is what are the dangers of artificial intelligence? What is it when 1,500 AI scientists signed an open letter to Scott for their own lab and every other lab to pause development to try and get better handle on how do we control this technology, and not one lab complied because there's way too much money involved. What was it, though, that was really bothering these guys? What are some of the key issues with artificial intelligence that 1,500 of the best minds were worried about? And what are the things that the executives who are posed to make billions and not trillions of dollars on this technology not wanting to talk about? And how does it play into economics or society, national security, defense? What are some of the things that that could go wrong with that technology? And then more important, how does that play back? How does that reflect back on the current stage of our society, our politics, religion, faith, prophecy, all of the things that drive a lot of the other emotional hot points that we're dealing with right now in the world? And so AI is not, some would say, well, it's going to solve all these other problems and do all these amazing things, which it will. But if we also look at how the negatives could actually, what sort of chemistry is that going to create with the current other environments? The AI is neither benign nor evil, right? It's neutral, but it's clearly one of the most powerful technologies we've ever created. As equal to, and I think in some senses to, the nuclear energy. And one of the ways I would differentiate them is the most powerful nuclear bomb ever created couldn't replicate itself, whereas we do have AIs that can start to do that. And so when we start to deal with a consciousness or an intelligence that by the end of 2024 will be smarter than any human on the planet, how do we know how to respond to certain parameters? And so we can bring some of those things in, and we can bring in how it reflects back on who we are as a human species, and how is that going to reflect back?
Awesome. We got a question from the audience, from our resident redneck, actually a resident hillbilly. Sure. I'm sorry. He said, how hard is it to keep up with technology? So many of the things he read 20 plus years ago were science fiction that have now become real life stuff.
I was in the industry for 40 years. I was saturated for 40 years. And even today, I feel like if I skip a couple of days, something happens that could be major. It's really hard to keep up with technology, particularly in how technology is now converging and creating a convergence with other aspects of science and business and in new ways that we've never had before. So yeah, I have to do research. I have hundreds, I have boxes of files, hundreds of computer files, probably thousands of pages. And I'm still doing research every single day just to try and stay on top of whatever nuance, the Q algorithms coming out of OpenAI, the nuances for the gravity, quantum level proof of gravity, or other, I'm messing that up, but the quantum elements of gravity. There's always elements that are really kind of playing into this. And some of those are some of the newer forms of computing that have the potential of outstripping even the most powerful computers today. not quite there yet, but really on the cusp, including quantum computing and neuromorphic computing. And so I'm constantly kind of not just narrowing my focus, but then staying focused on all of the technology issues. And then, of course, the political situations that I bring in and the prophetic situations I bring into my books are also constant research. So I think I love to research, and the writing actually gives me an excuse to do something with it. I think of all the parts of the process I love the most, it's sometimes just going through different articles and watching different videos and finding different experts and reading different books and saying, oh, wow, that's cool. Oh, wow, that's terrifying. Oh, wow, how can I put this into a book? But yeah, it's constant.
Hope that answers your question. You said many thanks to the question there. So I think you hit it on the head for him. Tell us a little bit about your association called Author Event Network and why you started it.
As an author, I'm a businessman first. And so when I started, when I first became an author, and I decided for a number of tactical business reasons to decide to self-publish, because it gave me greater control. The process of production of a book in terms of high quality content, editing, covers, websites, promotion, were all going to be on me anyway. And I could replicate what a typical publisher would do, and they keep the profits. But I also wanted to be also in control of the content, since I knew I was going to be touching on a lot of potentially controversial points with technology, politics, religion, social issues, et cetera. But one of the hardest things for any author, no matter how, and every single one of my books has been compared to either Dan Brown or Robert Ludlum. I've gotten gold awards, silver awards, favorite 25 books of 2021 from BookTrib, finalists for books of the year. The quality is, you can have a great quality product, but then the promotional marketing part is always the part that kills a lot of authors, because it's the hardest, and it's the one thing that traditional publishers are no longer doing the way they did back in the 60s and 70s. And so I did some book signings at Barnes & Noble. Those were very successful, sold out all the books they had, but I wanted to come back and do that again. And they said, well, great, come back when you have your next book. I said, well, that's a year away. And so I wanted a way of meeting, doing more book signings and meeting, engaging new readers with the backstories of the book, because if I just tell them the backstories, they almost always want to buy the books. And I discovered, by accident, went to a local big festival fair kind of thing. You get them all over the place in the summertime. You know, from spring to autumn, you see them all over the place. And they can get anywhere from a few thousand up to a couple hundred thousand people at these things. And I was there at one point, and I realized that there was jewelry and honey and t-shirts and art and crafts and, you know, knickknacks and junk and toys and blah, 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 blah. But I thought, well, what if you had a booth of authors signing their own books? You could have different variety of genres. You can have different styles. There's got to be a portion of all these people who are readers. And rather than waiting for them to come into the bookstore, and when I was at Barnes & Noble, the biggest Barnes & Noble I was at got maybe 300 to 500 people in that one afternoon. Well, I'm getting multiples of that at these festivals. And so I realized that there were other authors also struggling with trying to get that exposure to the reader. And so we formed the group. We've got a chapter in Seattle, a chapter in Portland. We're up to about 50 authors right now. Most of them are accomplished, meaning that they're either published or they've done about 10 or more books, award-winning. Some of them, a couple of them are bestseller book authors. And we go out and we share booth space and time and cost at all these local festivals. And as a result, we're busy. We'll have close to 60 to 70 signing days, book signing event days, between the middle of April and the end of November, December, where the holiday markets finally end. And from every weekend, starting the first weekend in May through mid-October, will be at least 1 to 4 or 5 days that weekend will be someplace. So this has grown tremendously. The response from the authors has been phenomenal. They really have all found that they can increase their sales, increase their exposure, find new readers, loyal readers who will come back the next event and say, oh, I read your last book. I loved it. Let me buy another one. And they're building their newsletters, and they're making really good margins and doing it. And the readers love it. The readers are loving to have a personal relationship with a local author that is becoming their favorite author. And if they don't like thrillers, maybe they like nonfiction. We have some great memoirs. Maybe they like sci-fi or fantasy or historical fiction or mystery and murder mystery. And so we basically say, well, what do you like? And we point them to somebody down in the booth.
That's an awesome awesome association right there. Hopefully something like that spreads nationwide for all the local.
I'd love to figure out a business model to allow it to spread. Right now, I'm involved. I don't get paid, but I do a lot of the organizing and payment and managing of things. And so if I could find a good, viable model, and what makes it a wonderful model is that by the time you split up the time and space in the booth across the authors, it breaks the cost down for these events where people are actually making money, as opposed to most author promotions where you're paying more than you're making. So it's sustainable. And so if I can find a way, if I raise the cost of doing it too high, then the authors aren't making money. There's no real value. Or there's some value. I mean, you're still selling books. You're still building your readership. But, we want the authors to make money. So I am looking for a way of creating a national model out of this and then figuring out how to recruit authors into chapters. But it is a great model.
Definitely is. And I look forward to hopefully you starting that tidal wave where it spreads across the country. So a lot of small towns that have the farmers markets and stuff can start standing up and saying, here's our local
product. I have to remind myself that I'm doing this because I love writing the books and researching. So I'm almost like, okay, this is big enough. I'm doing all the events I want to do. I still want to write. So I'm actually working on my next book. I've got two more books planned after that and a screenplay. So I've got a whole backlog of projects I want to try and get to. So I'm trying to moderate how much I'm spending on the author event network, in part because of all that. If I could find a way of extending it where I don't have to really commit much more time, then I'm certainly willing to do that.
I'm sure someone will say, hey, I'll help you do it, and that you still be creative and just poke your head in every once in a while and say, hey, how's it going? Do you need a hand? No, good. See you later. And that's the best way to do it.
Yeah. I think there is a model out there. I just have to spend some time kind of figuring out, finding the right people to do it.
Definitely. And Guy, if you could give advice to the aspiring author that's out there, three bits of advice, what would that be?
Oh, one, do your homework. Don't believe that just because you have a story that you can write. Either take lessons, go take master classes, read books on how to write and structure characters and plots and themes. Don't do what I did, which is basically do it wrong 50 times before you can finally get one that worked. So do your homework to get a good baseline idea of what it is you want to do with your premise, with your story. Second one is write the first book. Just write it. If you just title your outlines, or if you want to just write and just go where it goes, however your style is, whether you're a pantser or a planner, just write the book. And don't even think about it. Don't even question it. It's just the truth. The first draft will always suck. And it's the polishing, but now that you've got something, and it's just like software, now that you've got a framework, you can iterate that, you can build on that, you can polish that, you can fix that. But if you wait till every single thing you do along the way is perfect, it'll never happen. And then the third thing I can say is get involved with other authors and other places where you can promote your work. Whether that's an author community or whether that's a local place where you can do a book signing, but find a place where you can engage with readers, because you're going to learn more from your readers than even your best editors. I would actually probably also squeeze in there. If you've got a publisher with a good editor, great. If you're indie published, don't skimp on the editing. The editing, your product is what people are buying, and that comes in your the craft and then the design. If you're going to invest in yourself, invest well and invest in good editing and good design.
Awesome. And where can people get in contact with you or check out your books?
Go to GuyMorrisBooks.com. You can email me or contact me from there. You can also get buy links. There's links to reviews. There's links to some of the books are on Audible. Swarm and The Last Ark are on Audible with a great narrator. He's a professional television actor and an operatic tenor named Brian Cheney. Did an amazing job. So everything is there, and including fact versus fiction pages. So after you've read the book, and I don't want people to read fact versus fiction till afterwards, but after you've read the book, you can go back and find out what was true and what was made up.
That's outstanding. Guy, thanks for taking some of your time tonight to hang out with us. His website is going across the bottom of the screen for those watching the video right now. It is in the show notes for everyone at all. Have it on your favorite podcast apps in a couple months when it comes out, or a month and a half, I guess, in April when it comes out on audio. Thanks again for taking some of your time tonight to hang out with us on the Misfit Nation, Guy.
My honor, sir.
Have a great night.
You too. Thank you, Rich.
For every veteran, there is a story. A story about a calling to serve, to fight for the freedoms of the American people. And every story has a struggle, a sacrifice, and invisible wounds. Warrior Wads programs help veterans recover from PTSD and invisible wounds through exercise, nutrition, and connecting with other veteran leaders. It is estimated that 22 veterans die each day by suicide, and another 30 veterans die each day by substance abuse. These are preventable deaths. Warrior Wad is committed to fighting PTSD through fitness, nutrition, and community.
Thanks for checking us out and being a part of the Misfit Nation show. Don't forget to visit our website at themisfitnation.com. That's themisfitnation.com. Check out all our past episodes and get some of the great Misfit Nation gear for you and your family. As always, be humble, stay hungry, and keep hustling, because we are
Misfit Nation. Misfit Nation.